Hello, hello, and welcome to Dancing in the Discomfort Zone podcast. One of the questions that's very much in the social conversation these days is women's rights and women's place in the world and equality and all of these aspects. And when I found out that I was speaking with today's guest at a similar virtual, the same virtual conference, I reached out to her and I said, "You seem awesome. I want you on my podcast," which is pretty much what I do for everybody. So if I meet you and say that, welcome to the podcast. But anyway, Jen Donahue was a naval officer. She's an engineer. She blows stuff up. This is a super fun conversation. But she has been, for her whole career, a very successful female in a very male-dominated area. And so I was curious to talk to her about her path and how she rose to high levels of success and management and leadership. And she was a Commodore of the Navy when she retired. I mean, she's making stuff happen. So I was really interested to talk to her about imposter syndrome, about succeeding in a male-dominated industry, and find out her secret, find out how she did it. And she did not disappoint. This is a fun, fast-moving conversation with somebody who's very intelligent and very emotionally intelligent. I guess I'm going to say she's psychologically intelligent or intellectually intelligent and emotionally intelligent. Very empathetic as well as being very logical. And it's a great study of and, which is a concept that I love. And it's the fact that things exist together, not as an either or situation. And I think getting away from black and white thinking and into more shades of gray thinking is such an important thing for us to do today. So this episode with Jen Donahue, Dr. Jen Donahue, or Commodore Jen Donahue, or just Jen, is awesome. It's a great study in so many factors, from imposter syndrome to gender equality and showing up and doing the stuff, and also humility and authenticity and building trust with your team. So this episode, like all of them, do not disappoint. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy this episode of Dancing in the Discomfort Zone podcast. All right, we are dancing in the discomfort zone today with Jen Donahue. Jen, how are you today?
I'm doing absolutely fantastic.
And where are you sitting?
I am in Bend, Oregon, which is smack dab in the middle of Oregon, like up in the mountains at about 4,000 feet.
I think we talked about this on LinkedIn. I was just out there a couple weeks ago. Holy moly, what a fun, beautiful place.
We absolutely love being here. There are so many things to do every single weekend. It doesn't matter if it's summer, winter, fall, spring. There's always something to do.
Well, and it seemed like the people were just lovely and just happy, positive. Again, when you got lots of wonderful outdoor stuff to do, you're a happier person.
We actually have a slogan, and it's like, be kind, you're in Bend.
I love it. Well, the reason I had you on the show, you and I are speaking at a virtual event together, not together, but we're at the same virtual event. But I saw that you had been a naval officer. You have been in a lot of situations where it's been a male-dominated situation, and you have succeeded in that. And so I wanted to kind of get your story, get your perspective, and share any insights you had on, on becoming a warrior, which is what you're talking about at our conference. So start from the beginning. Tell me your story.
Well, I'm an engineer and I wear many hats. I went into the United States Navy right out of college and I was one of the 9%. So there's so few women in engineering to begin with and so few women in engineering that decide to join the United States Navy. Mm. So I was part of the 9% and it was a fantastic experience. I traveled all over the world. I was in Guam, Puerto Rico, Alaska. In Alaska, I was drilling and blasting, which is like really so much fun. And it really is a blast.
Stress relief.
But I also went to Iraq and I was a commanding officer of battalion 800 people when I was in Afghanistan. I retired in March of 2022 as the Commodore of the 1st Naval Construction Regiment. And so I was in charge of 2,000 people and they were deployed all over the world and also reservists, active duty, things like that. But also as an engineer, when I wasn't out doing these types of things. I own my own company and I do high-end seismic engineering for dams, bridges, nuclear power plants. And so all of these are very, very male-dominated industries. But I found a way to navigate through all that and still try to be my true self.
Well, and I love it because you're saying being part of that 9% was such a good experience. You liked it. You liked that. Did you find it a challenge? Did you find it that there were barriers left and right that you were fighting, or did your work speak for itself?
There were barriers. I will say that. But I'm one of those people who is like, it's a barrier. Hey, let's go after it. Let's try to get over it.
Let's blow it up.
Around it, whatever it is. It's like, yeah. Let's go do it. And I was, you know, I grew up on a block with like all boys, you know, so I grew up, you know, climbing trees and hopping fences. And just most of my life, I've been around guys all the time. So I knew how to navigate how they joked and how they talked. And it was really easy to fit in. And I didn't feel like I was standing out too much. I did notice that some of my other female counterparts who hadn't been around a lot of guys all the time, they were having a hard time adjusting. And so I tried to help them as well. Like, hey, you know, here's some things that we can do to navigate. But at the same time, in 1998, I was only the third female officer that the battalions had ever had because they were just finally letting women into some of these combat roles. So that was really challenging and trying to navigate. How do we do this? You know, how is something brand new and just trying to forge your own path? But that's just sort of who I am. It's like, hey, let's go after it. Let's try to figure it out. Let's try to do this as a team. Let's try to get everybody together on the same page.
Wow. Well, so the transition now, speaking to imposter syndrome and getting over, you know, the internal mental hurdles so that you can achieve, is that kind of where that was born?
It was. Because you start to think about, am I really good enough to be here? You look around at all the people and they don't look like you. And so you think, maybe I don't belong. And that's the one part that I've realized is like, no, this is going to kill my career if I think about this. And I realized, no, you know what? I am here. I am here for a purpose. They brought me in here because they thought that I was good enough. They're not going to take a risk and just randomly bring somebody in. But there was somebody who believed in me and trusted me. And I had to realize that, you know what? I do belong here. And I had to convince myself sometimes before trying to convince others.
And was it that sort of what I call borrowed belief that kind of helped you turn that voice around? Because I talk about that voice in my keynote. It is loud and mean and very convincing.
You know, I think about Odysseus and, you know, going back into history, and you remember the story of the sirens and how they used to try to lure people in. That's my imposter syndrome. You know, I start to think about, you know, what can I do? And then you hear this little voice in the back of your head and it tries to lure you in and say like, you're not good enough. You don't belong, just so that it can just basically like bash you across the rocks and like you have no hope whatsoever. And so that's the way that I think about it. It's like this little siren song just trying to lure you in slowly so that it can crush you. And so that's how I think about it. You know, so everybody has their own way of saying, oh, well, this is mine and this has a voice. It's like, no, mine are the sirens from Odysseus.
I love it. I think in cartoons, you think in Greek mythology. I like it. It's very dramatic. Very dramatic. Well, so it sounds like you use that borrowed belief from somebody else. And I use this in restaurants when I see something on a menu that I'm like, really? And I'm like, somebody thought that was a good idea. I'm going to go ahead and eat it. So like that borrowed belief in yourself saying somebody thought it was a good idea for me to be here. So I'm going to go do my thing. What other strategies did you use to kind of quiet that imposter? And were you able to shut it up all the time? Or did you have to keep revisiting the conversation?
The crazy thing is that I have to keep revisiting the conversation.
Even today, right?
Even today. Like I went out and when I was speaking at another event and I started looking at all of the other speakers, how accomplished they were, how many books they had. And I thought, what do I have to offer the audience? Mm-hmm. And then I start to think about what I call my interior warrior. And it's like this piece of me that says, hey, you know what? I've done this before. And I have to start thinking about, you know what? I have a message. I have a mission and I can help these people.
I love it. And that's such an important thing to say, A, somebody thought this was a good idea. And B, I actually have a lot of qualities and things to, I always tell people, like, keep a list. Because when the sirens start singing, you need to pull that list out and say, okay, wait a minute. I'm really good at this and this and this, right?
And this is something that I talk about in my keynote also. It's like, I have a good friend, his name is Phil, and he has a little book. Every time he has a win, he writes it down. And so whenever he starts to feel imposter syndrome come back up, he just grabs his book and he starts to read through all of those things that he's done in the past. And he realizes, you know what? I've been here before. I can do it again. And one of the things that I used to do is I used to go over to the printer, grab a clean sheet of paper, and just start writing down like all of my accolades. The fact that I won the science fair in junior high, you know, silly things like that. You know, I made it through the PhD program at Berkeley without having to become a hippie. You know, all these different things. It's like, you know, write it down. And then you start thinking about, hey, how did I do that? How did I, you know, was I studying harder? Was I, you know, all these things. And you start to piece it together and you realize, hey, you know what? I can do whatever this thing is that's in front of me right now.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. And again, it's an ongoing battle, right?
It is.
And I'd love to talk to you about another thing, because on your website, if I were to just go and look at that, not knowing that you're an engineer, that you blow stuff up and that you were a Commodore in the freaking Navy, which is a big deal. I just I'm not going to say a normal person, but like a normal person. And I don't mean it that way, but I mean like, you know, just somebody that I'd know walking down the street. So, and one of the things you say is that your authenticity is also important to you. And this is something that I'm exploring where it's like, okay, yes, there's this big combat background. There's this big intelligence, you know, PhD engineering background, and I'm a cool lady that you want to go have coffee with. So talk to me a little bit about this authenticity piece that you seem to be grasping really well.
I truly believe that I am just a normal person. Maybe it's, I don't have an ego or whatever it is, but I want to be relatable to people. And so that's something that whenever you meet me on the street, you'll never know that I was a Commodore. You don't know that I have a PhD, but my job is to try to connect with you as a human. And to me, that's the most important part. You know, if I come in and say, I am Commodore Donahue, I have a PhD, blah, blah, blah. All right. How relatable is that? It's not
great. Nice, you know, to meet, like, you. Bye.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I got to go now. But if I just be my true, genuine self, that somebody who wants to help people, who cares about people, I want to hear your story. To me, those are very exciting things. And so I think that's part of where the authenticity comes from, is that in my heart, I believe that I was put on this earth to help people. And so that's what I tap into. And so these other things, you know, they're just letters after my name, to be honest. And my true purpose is to be here for the people of the world and try to help them be a little bit better.
Mm. And every once in a while I get to blow things up.
Oh yeah, totally.
Of course. Well, and so there's a dichotomy here. It's not a dichotomy in real life, because the there's this and concept that I find so fascinating. Like, you are this, you know, PhD, Commodore, all these achievements, and you are also full of humility and engageable, what's the word?
Relatable?
Relatability. Yes, that's exactly it. So how do you find, I think if, as people say, I keep a list of things I've accomplished. I keep a list of all the things I've figured out, and I'm a very relatable, down to earth person. They don't see those things as an and, they see them as an or. So talk to me a little bit about this melding of those two pieces.
I think part of it is who we are. And I know that sounds kind of like fluffy, but really, there are people that I know that have been in the military, and whenever they are walking down the street, you can tell that even when they're in civilian clothes, that they were in the military. You know, just the way that they walk, they have their haircut and all these other things that, like, just, it just exudes from their body. I don't think I'm necessarily like that. I think that all of us are multifaceted, and there are pieces that we can show on the outside from time to time. And so for me, I have definitely looked at that, at the facet of how am I perceived by others. And so it's a very self-aware type of thing of like, how am I perceived? But I will tell you that as soon as I put on my uniform, Like all of a sudden, there's a change. All of a sudden, I stand up straighter. Yeah. All of a sudden, there's a different confidence. My voice drops a little bit deeper, and there's a different persona that is coming out of me at that time. It's not something that I necessarily plan, but it's just something that really happens that whenever I just literally put on a uniform, I change a little bit. It's the same thing whenever I go and I teach classes. I teach at UCLA and UC Berkeley. And whenever I stand in front of the students, you know, we're having a nice conversation, you and I, but whenever I stand in front of the students, that's also a little bit different. And that's just a different facet of something that I want to be seen as opposed to my normal kind of goofy self that I really am.
Well, and it sounds like an identity plus role aspect, right? As an officer in the military, you have a certain role that you play that in order to command credibility and people's respect and listen to what you're saying, there's a certain role that you need to play. You know, like when, if I worked for a bank, I probably would have a different hairdo because I'm not sure if somebody would give me their money with this hair, and I'm okay with that. But it's an interesting thing as we think about authenticity and think about imposter syndrome and feeling like we are genuinely in our own skin, that study of identity and role is fascinating.
And one of the things I always try to make sure of is that when I do look at these different facets, that I'm still being true to myself. I think that's the most important part. So whenever I am in my military uniform, I'm not going to be an a-hole. I'm not going to be a jerk. I'm going to basically still be who I am, somebody who cares about everybody else. My demeanor might be slightly different. For instance, like I said, I stand up taller, my voice drops a little bit more, but in the back of my mind, I'm still thinking about, hey, how can I do best by my troops? How can I make sure that they're prepared? How can I make sure that they are getting what they need, which is still true to my real personality?
Well, and in that military setting, like with first responders, like like law enforcement, like we need to be able to make decisions and order people around, quote unquote, and have them feel confidence in our leadership because they're probably terrified. And so that strong demeanor is vital.
Because everybody's watching you, especially when you're in the leadership position. It doesn't matter if you are law enforcement or first responder or military. If you're in a leadership position, people are watching you all the time. Mm-hmm. You can't really slip up because all of a sudden people might start to see right through you. And so there is something that you basically have to say, okay, I am on. And, this is who I am. This is how we're going to go forward. Because people also take cues off you. If you are confident and you're going in, you know what? They're going to have confidence themselves. If you go in kind of like, I don't know. Guess what? That's not going to inspire confidence. That's probably not going to get the job done.
Right. And so when that siren song starts to sing in that moment, it's being able to say, all right, we planned for this. This is not the time. You need to park it. I'll drive my boat into your rocks later.
Exactly. It's all about also just trying, for those who are sort of new to some of the leadership, I would say start to practice these things. Mm-hmm. If you do have imposter syndrome, have people start throwing situations out at you and start to think, how would I go through this situation, if it were real? Mm-hmm. And that'll help you in your reaction time as you start to go through. And that helps also combat that imposter syndrome because you know what to do. You've practiced. And you've been under a little bit of stress in order to do that. We don't take, these young 25-year-olds and put them in charge of 400 people. You start out with 4 people and then you might go out to 16 people. And so you start to build that repetition and you start to realize, hey, you know what? I can do this because I've done it before. Whenever I was in Iraq, I had a combat commander who would never talk to anybody else except for me. Because he said, I was the only one who wouldn't freak out whenever like bad stuff happened. He's like, everybody else I talk to in the command center, they just like start freaking out. He's like, you're the only one I want to talk to because you were calm and collected. And it's like, it's only because I had had all of that practice beforehand that I could stay calm in a lot of those really tense situations.
Yeah. Well, and you suggest this role playing, have people throw ideas at you. And you know what? Role playing is the number one most awkward and uncomfortable thing to practice. And studies show it is the number one way to have low stakes practice for high stakes situations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in the military, we do this over and over and over again. We're something that we're really, really good at. I haven't seen it as much out in the civilian practice, but man, if you start to put it in the civilian practice, yeah, it's uncomfortable and it's kind of like icky, but you know what? Start to practice, start to think of like all the things that can go wrong and start to work through those, work through it with your team so that whenever something happens, every member on your team knows exactly what to do in the same type of crisis. But just doing that repetition over and over and over again, that's why the military is so good at many of these types of crises.
Yeah, they say everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face, right? Until you got somebody shooting at you from the hill across the way.
That's true. Well, yeah. We always say that most plans, you know, only survive first contact. But that's why you have branch plans. That's why you have backup plans. You have like plans upon plans upon plans, you know, so that you have all of that. You have alternatives.
Right. And having come up with all those plans in that moment, even if everything goes completely the opposite direction, you have that practice of coming up with plans. And so you have that belief in your ability, that deep-seated belief in your ability to figure things out. And you're not going to like panic, run around in circles and then pass out like one of those goats.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. No, you've hit it right on the head.
Yeah. I love it. So talk to me about, you know, no human is always strong. You know, I think you and I have very confident, strong personalities. We've achieved things, so we have that belief and all that. But talk to me about your moments of recovery, your moments of weakness is the wrong word, but where you let yourself not be the strong one.
I think whenever I'm not the strongest, is whenever I'm around other people who are very strong. So for instance, my husband is a very strong person. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's an FBI bomb tech. He's a very strong person. And whenever I'm around him and I can just like relax and sort of let everything go. And to be honest, I'm also an introvert. I am shy. I know that might sound crazy, but whenever I'm around others who are extroverted, who are big and strong people, I feel like at that point I can actually relax a little bit and say, hey, you know what? I'll be a good follower. If you need some advice, I'm here for that. And so for me, those are some of my times to recover is whenever I'm around somebody who maybe outranks me or whatever it might be. Those are the times when I feel like I can just sort of let the guard down just a little bit, be a little bit more quiet and let them run.
Yeah. And just be confident, like things are taken care of. I'm good. You don't need me right now. Well, and right. That's a humility thing too, isn't it? It's that, and I imagine this is just who you are, but saying, hey, I can be in charge if you need me to, I will kick some serious butt and we will have a great successful thing. But if you don't need me, I'm good over here. I'll just help. And that's such an important, again, one of those ands of a great leader being genuinely a good, humble follower as well when the situation calls for it.
Oh man, it gets so confusing whenever you have so many strong personalities and they're all trying to compete. Nothing gets done. You have to have that one person who is either appointed or whatever means they are to be in charge, and everybody else has to just fall in line. You can't just sit there and argue and try to beat each other. You're never going to go anywhere. But if you are able to say, hey, you know what? You got this. If you need me, I am here. Mm-hmm. Let's go forward. Yeah. So much more smooth that way.
Well, and there's a trust factor, right? This always comes in when we talk about leadership, when we talk about, you know, any kind of leadership, there's a level of trust that has to be in there. And I think that's something, again, as you talk about things the military and military training does really well, is and something that I've heard from four people who are now out of the military and in civilian life saying, I don't know who's got my back. The whole time I was in Afghanistan, I knew who had my six. I knew who had here. All I had to worry about was my job because I trust the rest of the people behind me. And how do we translate that? I mean, I'm getting way off into the different topics now, but how do we translate that to civilian life? Because that is such a key thing.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. And trust is something that I also talk a lot about in other keynotes is how do we build trust with our personnel? And I think it really starts with really understanding who it is that's around you. I had a boss and he would come and he had note cards for every single person in the company. He would write down their name. He would write down their spouse's name. He would write down important things about them. So when he would go and talk to them in the different offices, he could have an intelligent conversation with them like, hey, how's your husband? Hey, how are you doing on that project? All of a sudden, it's like, wow, this person actually cares about me. They're interested in me. Because he believed that the entire company of 1,200 people, that was his family. Mm-hmm. And he treated everybody like family. He wanted everybody to just feel like they could relax. And the trust and the loyalty and that place was incredible. Nobody left the company. People were coming to the company because they wanted to work for him and the way that he made everybody in the company feel. So I think it really starts with asking questions whenever you're in the civilian, like just get to know, do they have a spouse? Do they have a significant other? Maybe a dog or a cat or what's their favorite football team? Whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting to know people and sort of letting your own guard down a little bit. And then asking questions. Hey, I don't really understand what this process is that you're doing. Can you explain that to me? All of a sudden, they're like, oh my God, like the boss is asking me questions about what I'm doing and I get to show off a little bit. And those are the type of things that start to build those interpersonal connections. And that's how you start to build trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some people listening might say, oh, he writes it down on a note card. That's really inauthentic. No, no. He's making the effort. I'm not going to remember 1,200 people's spouse names and birthday, but I do want to remember it. Our brains are not fit to remember that crap. And the fact that he's making that effort, that's it right there. It's saying I care about you as a human, not just somebody to fix the spreadsheets.
Right, exactly. Every time he would fly out to a different office, he would just grab that stack for that office and he would sit on the plane and he would go through all of those note cards. And then at the end of the day, if he had something that he talked to you about, like he'd go in and revise the note card. Oh, we talked about this or whatever it might be. Yeah, you can't remember 1,200 people and their spouses and all the other stuff. Yeah. But that's how he did it because he was afraid his memory was going to fail and he was going to forget some of the important conversations that he had with his people.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a key piece. And that goes back to that authenticity too, right? You know, like I care about my people as people because I know they're also going to care about my business and take care of my business,
right?
But not if they don't feel like they belong, they're welcome, they're relevant, and they're valued.
Absolutely.
I love it. So switching gears a little, how did you make the transition? You said you were in the military until 22, so that's not very long ago. Is that when you started speaking?
I started speaking a little bit earlier than that. So I was in the reserves for the last several years, but they kept calling me back to active duty. So I'd be on active duty,
with good
then
people.
I go into the civilian world. So I kind of go back and forth. And so one of the biggest transitions that I found is that whenever I would come back out of the military, is that whenever I was upset with people, I couldn't make them do pushups. That was like the biggest transition for me is like, I'm so upset with this person. I just want them to do pushups to get it right. Apparently you can't do that. You get called into the HR department. It's a whole master's paperwork, things like that. So
tell you what, if you want to go to a company where you could, I used to work for a fitness company called Les Mills. And if we were late to meetings, we had to do pushups. So there you go. Anyway, but go ahead.
It was a big transition. And every time that I would come off active duty and back into the reserves, I'd have to like, almost like recalibrate my brain. I was always in a position of leadership whenever I was in the military. And so it was very easy to say, this is what we need to get done. This is the timelines that we need to get it done by. Everybody kind of goes off. They know what they need to do and you go. I found that in the civilian world, you know, trying to use the same type of terminology, the same type of voice inflection did not get as far. You basically have to tone it down a little bit and have that more interpersonal type of relationships. You know, hey, Jan, you know, we need to get this done by such and such date. What do you need? Blah, blah, blah. And having more of the conversations and then go off. We didn't seem to have a lot of conversations in the military. It's just like, I need this spreadsheet. I need it by Friday. Everybody's like, got it out, you know? And so it was more of like, okay, let's be human. Let's have a conversation. Let's talk about other things. So that was one of the biggest things. It was like, okay, I can't just be so curt and so short. I need to have a little bit more explanation about what I need, some of the parameters that I need it done by. And once I got into the groove of it, it was a whole lot easier.
Nice. And so getting into speaking then, is this what you do full time?
It is. And I love speaking because what it is it provides the opportunity to still help people. Whenever I was in the military, again, that was all about like, how can I help people? How can I give them the skills that they need? How can I make sure that they're ready to go if we are called up into another conflict? And it was, I loved all of the interpersonal dynamics that we had. I mean, we had people from all over the nation that were in the command. You know, we had people from Puerto Rico and Hawaii and New York, you know, and trying to get all of those different personalities and figure out, what do all these people need? How can I make them as successful as possible? Well, when I retired, then that all went away. And so now as a speaker, my job is to try to get to like all of these people from Puerto Rico, Hawaii, New York, Alaska, wherever it might be. I was in Romania. How can I help them just be better? How can I help them with the obstacles that have come up in their way? How can I get them unstuck? Mm. And I've had so many people who have come up to me and said, hey, you know what? I've been stuck for a while. And you know what? Now I have a way around that. To me, man, every time I hear that, I'm like, yes. Like I have helped this person. And it's like, if I can just help a couple people every time that I speak to just get over that fear of failure for whatever it might be, man, that's what helps me keep going.
That's awesome. I love it. I love that that's your mission. Well, where can people find you if they're interested in looking into your speaking?
I'm available at jendonahue.com, Jen with two N's. And they can also go to LinkedIn. I'm on Jen Donahue in LinkedIn. Those are probably the best ways to do it. So either go to the website, go to the LinkedIn. I'm on each of them daily.
Okay, great. I will put those in the show notes for anybody who wants to get in touch with people. Jen, this has been so fun and so enlightening. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your service and for everything you've done for us and continue to do for us here in the United States.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really been an honor. I really appreciate you reaching out to me. Thank you. And thank you for everything that you're doing. Thank you for everything that you're doing for all of the people who have subscribed to you, because you are helping them on a weekly, daily basis as well. So thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, my mission's the same as yours. Help them get over all the discomfort and move it along.
Exactly.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is why I do this. So I get to meet cool people and talk to them about cool things. Imposter syndrome is something that we all have. We all have that siren song in our head, as she said. Mine is, my voice of doubt is named Sally. She's an elf. She's adorable and she wants to keep me alive and she wants to keep me from doing absolutely anything that causes stress or danger, even if it doesn't actually cause a whole lot of danger. And the fact is, the more we talk about this uncomfortable aspect of ourselves, the more we build the skills, like Jen said, of quieting that voice by saying, you know what? Somebody believed that putting me here was a good idea. Or making that list. I have figured out this. I achieved this. I accomplished this. And maybe you don't have a PhD in engineering. You don't blow things up and you didn't run a 2,000 person group in the military. The group is totally wrong word, but you know, I wasn't in the military, a big group of people. Anyway, maybe you didn't do those things, but you have accomplished, you have figured out, you have overcome an incredible amount of things in the time you've been alive. Make that list, remind yourself of those things when that very convincing and sometimes really mean voice in your head starts squawking. Thank you for listening to another great episode of Dancing in the Discomfort Zone podcast. My name's Ann Bonney. I am and will always be your host, unless I'm able to sell this thing. And then I'll be in Bali on the beach and you won't be able to find me, but I'll leave you with a really good host. But for now, you're stuck with me. I hope you're stuck with me next week too. We've got more great content coming up. Thanks for listening.